I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Did you know that in the United States Congress, there is a task force on livable communities? Is your congressman a member? Earl Blumenauer is. He represents Portland, Oregon, and the people of the 3rd District in Congress, and he founded the House Livable Communities Task Force. He travels the nation advocating for the changes he believes are needed to make our communities better places to live. He is the keynote speaker at this week's Railvolution Conference. Joining him there is Greg LeRoy. He's founder and director of the nonprofit center Good Jobs First. He says that his studies show that too many public subsidies for business are working against the goals established for them and run counter to livable communities. We'll talk with Congressman Earl Blumenauer and Greg LeRoy today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The Honorable Earl Blumenauer is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing Oregon's 3rd District, which includes Portland and its suburbs. He's an active member of the House Livable Communities Task Force, which he founded in 1997. In 1999, Congressman Blumenauer was named Legislator of the Year by the American Planning Association. You founded the House Livable Communities Task Force. What were you hoping to accomplish, Congressman?
The goal is to put the spotlight on things that really make a difference to American families, to make them safer, healthier, and economically secure. So much of what happens in Washington, D.C. is sort of beside the point, hopelessly partisan, but the nuts and bolts of transportation, clean air, clean water, affordable housing, how we put the pieces together is something that profoundly affects Americans from coast to coast. We wanted to help equip members of Congress to understand ways that they could make a difference on these issues.
And how can they make a difference?
Well, it starts with very simple, fundamental investments in infrastructure, whether it's water, transportation legislation. There'll be opportunities this next session of Congress when they review the Farm Bill, which will have profound impact on rural America, small towns, but also for those interactions between big cities and the surrounding farm belts that almost all of them have in their periphery. The aftermath of Katrina actually was an opportunity. Sadly, because we fumbled so badly, it still hasn't gone away. But ways that we respond to prepare for disaster, recover from disaster, and prevent it in the first place. Those are some of the many ways that Congress can make a difference.
One of the complaints frequently heard is that Congress deals with the budget and various pieces of legislation in real silos. And you talked about the need to add things up to build a complete picture. How do you do that given the environment there and given the way legislation comes to you?
Well, that was one of the reasons why we tried to organize a forum so that people could discuss the interconnections. This notion that we're going to deal with water over here, we're going to deal with rail transportation over here, and we're going to deal with how the federal government manages its own office activities, for example, that's separate and apart, is extraordinarily frustrating. But I think we're making progress for people to see the connections. For example, the disaster that was Katrina in the Gulf states, particularly New Orleans, people are understanding, well, that was profoundly affected by the way that other federal agencies treated the Mississippi River as sort of a machine and not looking in a holistic fashion or allowing coastal erosion the other way. It's interesting that people at the grassroots level understand the connections in the big picture. Citizens around the country care about the framework of the ICE-T legislation for transportation reauthorization that looks a little bit at the big picture and planning. Much of what's going to happen in the next Congress, I think, is going to be driven by that pressure at the grassroots, which is so important to get Congress's attention and have them break through some of these silos.
I was reading a piece in the New York Times recently that talked about the push in Europe in particular to mitigate global warming by moving short-haul airplane trips to rail. Of course, there's been very limited commitment in this country, maybe no commitment at all, to rail. Do you see any interest, any growing interest at all in Congress in funding short-haul rail for passengers?
Well, actually, it has been grassroots pressure and a number of members of Congress pushing back that has kept Amtrak alive. You know, the administration last time tried to zero it out of the budget. And the Republican leadership had just each session has been cutting it back rather dramatically. But we were able to have a bipartisan coalition put back over $500 million for Amtrak funding. That was every Democrat but one, and over 70 Republicans. So there is interest. People are starting to understand that the quickest way to deal with not just global warming, but the congestion in our major airports, two-thirds of America's top airports, 100 airports, are involved with some sort of expansion for new runways and parking and whatnot. If we are able to take advantage of logical rail corridors, we're able to dramatically reduce not just the environmental effects, but the congestion, the gridlock, in ways that I think is growing in awareness. And again, we have a number of states that have stepped up here in the Pacific Northwest. The state of Washington, and to a lesser extent, my home state of Oregon, have put money in the Seattle to Portland train link. And we've just barely scratched the surface of that.
Is there anything fundamentally wrong with Amtrak that keeps it from being a good solution to the air congestion you're speaking of?
What's fundamentally wrong with Amtrak is that it has been given an impossible mission, and Congress hasn't even funded the limited amount of money that it's authorized. We've tried to reauthorize the Amtrak legislation, and that has been hung up. It hasn't been allowed to come to the floor, where I think there would be bipartisan support to pass it. It was stunning to watch last year when the Michael Brown, the famous Brownie of FEMA fame, was still on the federal payroll, and they fired David Gunn, the tremendously successful turnaround expert that they had as the CEO of Amtrak. So it's Amtrak that has been hammered, that has been hamstrung, that hasn't had a full board, that hasn't been given a capital budget, that is fighting for its existence every session of Congress. It's a wonder that it runs at all. It's a wonder that it runs at all. And it's quite frustrating because some of these people who are critics of Amtrak, who think that we should be the only major country in the world, and actually most minor countries, have rail passenger service that is at a significant level. We are the only one that should expect that it be entirely self-supporting. This is the same Congress that gives billions of dollars of subsidy to the airline passenger industry with loans, with air traffic control, with airport expansion subsidized. And this is an industry, the air passenger industry, that in its entire history has not shown a net profit. The duplicity and hypocrisy is extraordinarily frustrating, and it's one of the reasons that Amtrak has had a tough go.
You've had the House Livable Communities Task Force in business now almost 10 years. Do you feel like you're making any progress on advancing your agenda?
I feel that there are significant advances that are taking place. I've been on the campaign trail here in 14 congressional districts in 11 states, and it's fascinating to me to watch people who want to discuss transportation, infrastructure, streetcars, bicycles, clean air, clean water. This was last week in rural western North Carolina. It was in Boise, Idaho, as well as in metropolitan Cincinnati. So I am encouraged that more members are sensitive to it, but I am extraordinarily pleased that we're seeing this grassroots pressure that is bubbling up in communities large and small. And I'm actually quite optimistic that we're going to see significant advances in the next session of Congress.
Where do you think that grassroots interest is coming from? What's motivating that? What's changed in 10 years?
Well, part of what's changed over the course of that period of time is that we're watching that the philosophy that was the underpinning for the original iced tea legislation with the late Senator Daniel Moynihan has given new tools to local governments. We're finding that the flexibility to deal with transit, with bike and pedestrian activities, has made a difference. In communities across the country where I was, I must say, not entirely popular 10 or 15 years ago, in Phoenix, Houston, Salt Lake City, Denver, when we were talking about a rail and land use agenda, now all of those cities, all of them, have embarked on their own light rail systems. They're paying more attention to the land use linkage, and citizens are stepping up. When they're aware that we've got, you know, 300-pound morbidly obese fifth graders, yet kids can't safely walk or bike to school, and they've come forward with the Safe Routes to School program, and Congress has responded with over two-thirds of $1 billion for this initiative in our last reauthorization. Citizens have a clear idea of what they want. They know that nobody's paving their way out of traffic congestion, and they have to have holistic solutions.
You've mentioned health concerns. You mentioned congestion. Do you think the environmental concern is also beginning to drive some of this discussion?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. People are, again, at the local level, they have to deal with the complete picture. If they've got problems with children suffering from asthma, if they've got problems with childhood obesity, if they're dealing with escalating health care costs, and being able to deal in a, you know, with the clean air, the clean water, these environmental initiatives are touching people. We have 300 local governments around the country that are saying, if the federal government can't figure out what to do with Kyoto and global warming, we'll step up, we'll do it, and it's exciting to see people understand that they can make a difference environmentally.
Tell me your number one priority for the task force.
Well, for me, it's this next session. It's going to be helping people look at the range of things we can do directly to get away from those silos that we mentioned earlier in our conversation. For instance, the federal government is the largest consumer of energy in the world. If we're able to have a more comprehensive approach to how the federal government itself deals with energy issues, if the new farm bill that is up for reauthorization in 2007, if we can help people understand whether they are in a big city or they're in a small rural community, they've got a stake in making that farm bill more comprehensive in its approach and giving people more tools. For me, it's helping people, as they say, connect the dots, an overworn phrase, but when it comes to the environment and livable communities, the dots are there to be connected.
And is that your toughest challenge, getting people to connect the dots?
It is. We are buffeted because there are all sorts of narrow special interests that are interested in narrow specific questions. It's so much easier if you're just dealing with this road issue, or you're just dealing with some petroleum-related question, or it's a budget that has been going along for years in a specific direction at a specific level. Being able to help people understand that these are complex and interconnected is the greatest challenge. But as I say, as I go to a different community around the country every month, and sometimes more frequently than that, I just find it extraordinarily encouraging the way that people get this. People are working with big picture questions in their community, and they're starting to move away from narrow little specific items. They see that they're going to be affected by all of these infrastructure, air quality, energy, housing. That's all part of a big pattern.
Is there an Earl Blumenauer formula for what makes a livable community?
You know, one of the things that I learned the hard way as a local official in Portland, for 10 years I was the Commissioner of Public Works on the City Council and responsible for things like transportation and land use and environmental services, I learned, as I say, as a result of some difficult experiences, that there is no cookie-cutter approach. That what's necessary is to be able to look at the resources that are available, the challenges, what the civic infrastructure, what the citizens will do. And as I've worked in other communities, it's clear that in some cases it's going to be water quality and transportation that's going to be the driver. In others, it's going to be the restoration of a historic neighborhood that provides a model. It is the key is for helping people develop their vision of what they want in Tucson or Kenosha or Seattle, having their vision, and then enlisting people and government and private resources to realize that vision. No cookie cutter approach, but the notion of developing citizen infrastructure and harnessing government to be a partner, absolutely essential.
Portland, which is part of the 3rd District you represent, ranks in the top 5 cities on so many critical measures. Why do you think that is? Why has Portland enjoyed so much success?
We've had a tradition, first of all, of civic engagement and planning. We're still finding that despite the bowling alone, that people here are willing to work together to meet, to plan, and strategize. We've had a combination, in some cases, of some interesting political leadership that took some risks and moved things forward, but they were usually pushed by citizen activists. We've benefited over the last 30 years by having a comprehensive statewide land use planning framework that made it easier to be able to look at the big picture. In fact, it made it hard, if not impossible, not to. That was our job. And last but not least, I think we've been very innovative in ways to try and educate and involve citizens, from active neighborhood groups to something that I'm very proud of that I started at the city, a transportation class to educate citizen activists about how transportation actually works and what they could do to change it.
It's hard to be against livable communities. Why isn't every member of Congress a member of your task force?
Well, there are lots of competing demands, and as you say, nobody's against it, but we don't have a large, well-funded lobby. There aren't political forces that place this at the top of somebody's agenda. Part of it is that there are elements that are woven together. And so if you get people focused on transportation or air quality or affordable housing, they can get quite excited. But when you get to a larger picture, sometimes the complexity, you lose the edge. So we're working very hard to have both the intellectual framework. We're trying to make people understand that they're part of a broader political coalition, and to put some potency behind it, both intellectually, politically, and practically.
Congressman, thanks so much for what you're doing, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Congressman Earl Blumenauer represents Oregon's 3rd District. He's the keynote speaker at this week's Railvolution National Meeting being held in Chicago. This week on Smart City, a new segment on the world of urban planning, design, and development from our friends at PlanEdison.com.
Last month, the United States reached a demographic milestone. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the 300 millionth American was born sometime in the middle of October. How the country handles its expanding population will become increasingly significant as the weight of this population growth stresses the country's housing supply, its infrastructure, and the global environment. With researchers predicting that the next 100 million will be added to the population by 2050, long-term planning will be critical. While many planners are concerned about the impacts of the growth on development and natural resources, commentator Joel Kotkin argues that America's growing population is not all bad news. In a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, Kotkin says that the population increase gives the nation a competitive advantage over other countries, spurring continued American innovation. By facing this expansion, he says, cities have been given the opportunity to reinvent themselves. One unlikely American city has already begun its own renaissance. By integrating far-reaching design standards with its master plan, the city of Omaha, Nebraska, may look to become one of the most progressively designed cities in the nation. Metropolis Magazine reports that Omaha's strict design standards are on the verge of being codified into law, and have already begun creating vibrant and walkable urban areas throughout the city. As planners and public officials look to revitalize their cities, they often look to the traditional urban designs of Europe. Now, one modern European design movement may be making its way into the U.S. In an opinion piece published recently on PlanEdison, authors Heike Meyer and Paul Knox predict that some cities in America will soon become part of the slow city movement, a series of principles which place emphasis on the unique attributes of a place, such as small businesses, locally owned restaurants, farmers markets, and other socially responsible enterprises. Whether part of a specific movement or not, creating a sense of place is becoming increasingly important to planners, architects, and city officials. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that the city's mayor and its urban design community have begun looking to alleyways as prime areas for infusing the city with dense, populated, and active plots for organic new urbanism. But the importance of walkable areas is not just recognized in big cities. According to the Washington Post, a mixed-use walkable town center was recently completed within the guarded gates of a Virginia Army base. As its population is facing a large increase over the next 5 years, the base's administrators decided to redesign with principles of new urbanism, including narrow streets, neighborhood parks, and affordable housing. As other military bases consider making similar changes, proposals have been made to transform two of the nation's most famous streets into pedestrian malls. Developers are considering making the entire stretch of New York City's 42nd Street into a pedestrian mall equipped with a crosstown light rail line. And public officials in California hope to convert part of Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills into a pedestrian-only street. Proponents argue that the changes will greatly increase economic activity on the two streets. And a new trend may be emerging in the field of environmentally conscious development. Grist magazine reported that the U.S. Green Building Council is crafting a way to expand its highly sought Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Building Standards, known as LEED, from concerning just single buildings to entire neighborhoods. The new LEED Neighborhood Development Standards look to create compact neighborhoods based on principles of walkability, a relevant mix of land uses, and an emphasis on environmentally friendly design and construction. Grist also recently reported on the creation of a home building method that sharply decreases construction waste and the environmental impact of construction materials and of the houses themselves. Sustainably farmed wood and on-site gray water recycling are some of the green features of this new method, known as cradle-to-cradle housing. And finally, Election Day is approaching, and a number of initiatives across the country are testing the limits of property rights. Voters in 13 states are facing decisions about how their states should regulate the acquisition of private property and how affected property owners should be compensated. At the heart of these initiatives is last year's ruling in the Supreme Court case of Kelo versus New London, Connecticut, which gave governments the authority to use eminent domain to condemn and acquire private property in the name of economic development for the benefit of the community. Voters will decide whether their states should limit the eminent domain powers granted to them in the Kelo case. Some states are also considering decisions about taxpayers compensating owners of private property that has been acquired through regulatory takings. Whatever the outcome of this election, these property rights decisions are sure to leave at least some stakeholders unhappy. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Greg LeRoy about incentives for business and how they may be working against the goal of making our communities better places to live. And we'll talk to Otis White about housing affordability. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, even with housing prices in decline in most major metro areas, affordability is still a problem. Have we learned anything about how to get housing prices down?
The short answer is no, we haven't, Carol. We're still struggling with that. Although this is at the top of just about every big city mayor's agenda, and a lot of smaller cities too, which is what can we do to hold on to our middle class and working class populations, whom we need to make this a real complete city. Unfortunately, all the strategies seem to revolve around subsidizing affordable housing, that is, taking money from the taxpayers and giving it to developers to build houses that people of lower incomes or working class incomes can afford. And maybe we are just simply aren't asking the right question, which isn't how we can create more affordable housing, but how we can make all construction a lot cheaper and simply trust that the private market, the private builders and developers, will build housing, if they can build it cheaply enough, will build housing that will attract middle-class and working-class families. And so you very well might ask, well, what could you do to make housing cheaper in cities? And that's a really great question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I know that's the question we need to be asking. Certainly one of the things that we could do is allow developers to build more densely, that is to put more floors in their buildings, because every time you go up one story, you dramatically lower the cost of the land that's beneath. It makes perfect sense. You take a one-story building and you make it two stories, you simply cut the price of the land underneath the building in half per unit. So we could increase density. We could make the permitting process simpler and less open to litigation, because it is because that really does increase dramatically the cost of development, and because it drags it out for so long. We could look at useless regulation. There are a lot of cities that require a minimum amount of parking in new developments, and maybe we don't need all of our developments to have allowances for two cars for every unit. And we could allow a lot more mixed use, because that creates additional revenue streams for the developers, and that might lower the cost of building as well.
I've seen a case study on this that suggests, too, there are enormous savings in terms of construction and construction materials if we can innovate in those two areas.
Yes, and we, gosh knows, we need to do some more innovating there. What we have to be careful about is not allowing the need for affordable housing to compromise the quality of the housing, but it need not be, and new materials might offer an opportunity for doing that. One of the things that cities can do very simply is invest in transit, because if we can get people to start looking at the cost of living in cities as involving more than just the price of housing, that is the price of transportation as well, we might make some housing that looks unaffordable much more affordable simply because you don't have to own two cars. You can maybe get by on one car, and that will dramatically decrease the amount of money you have to spend. So anyway, all of these strategies do not involve the city handing over money to developers. It really requires a rethinking of what can cities do to make the opportunity for private investment to build affordable housing a lot more realistic.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. Greg LeRoy is author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. He's also founder and director of the nonprofit center Good Jobs First. Along with Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Greg will appear at the National Railvolution Conference being held this week in Chicago. Greg, by your definition, what is a good job?
A good job is a full-time job if people want it to be. It has health care and it has a wage that enables people to live independently, that is, not relying on food stamps or Medicaid or housing assistance, but can support a family.
You contend that public subsidies for corporate moves and expansions are a bad idea. Why?
Well, because usually if a company is going to move, it's going to stay in the same metro area. It's going to try to retain its existing workforce, and therefore there's no reason to pay the company to stay where it's going to want to go anyway. Better to try to retain it where it is now, help the company expand in its existing location if possible, but in any respect, don't waste money paying somebody to do something they would do otherwise.
What about job training subsidies? Do you oppose those?
No, I actually favor most workforce development programs. I think we need more skilled labor, especially with all the boomers that are about to start retiring.
How about subsidies to encourage a business to locate in a tough neighborhood?
And that's another kind of incentive that I think does make sense, as long as you really got the rules tight to target and bring people back to areas that otherwise really would not get an investment.
Small business loans and counseling?
I'm also very much in favor of that. I think there's lots of scholarship to suggest that some of the best bangs you can get for the buck involve helping small businesses, acknowledging that many of them won't make it, but those that do will thrive to the point where the overall payoff is quite large.
Do you oppose tax increment financing, which allows gains in tax receipts resulting from new development to be spent on public improvements in the area?
TIF, tax increment financing, is one of the very most problematic subsidies I find any place. The problem is, in many states, the rules have become relaxed to the point where TIF can go almost anywhere. TIF can go to cornfields. TIF can go to big box retail that's just taking jobs away from other existing retailers. Most places now, I would say TIF has mutated into something I couldn't support.
So you support some public subsidies for business, but not all. What constitutes for you an appropriate public subsidy?
I think broadly, a subsidy that addresses what are called market imperfections by economists, that is, helping bring revitalization back to areas that really have been redlined or disinvested, bringing jobs to people that would not get them otherwise, you know, helping reduce the perceptions of risk for investors to come back to areas that are, for whatever reason, good or bad, viewed too risky. The trouble, and those good intentions were the ones that were draped around many of the incentive programs we have today. The trouble is, over time, they get amended in ways that allow them to go everywhere.
Some of those subsidies do not provide a good job by your definition. Are you comfortable with that?
I think as taxpayers, it's very hard to justify subsidizing a job that's not going to enable people to become self-sufficient. And this is a very widely accepted idea now. More than 42 states, for at least one of their incentive programs, and in some cases many of their incentive programs, attach some kind of job quality standards, that is, some kind of wages, full-time hours, healthcare standards. 45 cities, 5 counties that we've identified. It's really a very commonly accepted idea now.
You've done a number of studies that suggest that sprawl is subsidized by tax incentives or tax subsidies to business. Explain that.
Yeah, we're in the process of finishing 3 big studies where we've mapped more than 5,000 individual company-specific economic development incentive deals. And the recurring theme in all of our findings in nine metro areas, seven metro areas in Michigan and Chicago area and Twin Cities area, is that if you look at the geographic distribution of these deals, it's very much a driving sprawl. You know, a lot of people have looked at different reasons why sprawl is occurring, and I think those other analyses are valid too. But if you ask yourself, where are we subsidizing jobs? Overwhelmingly, we're finding the jobs are in thinly developed areas, in fringe areas, in affluent areas, in areas that are the least needy by measure of poverty or plant closings or other economic distress factors. In the case of the Twin Cities, we actually chanced upon a unique set of data generated by that state's very good disclosure law, where we actually looked at 85 companies that moved and got subsidies to move in a four-year period. And the story there is really quite disheartening. The overwhelming trend was to move outwardly. Some of them moved very long distances outwardly, away from transit, away from pockets of poverty, away from areas with tax-based stress, into more affluent areas with less transit.
So as you track these 5,000 individual economic development deals in these three areas, you did not find that in part those subsidies were going to businesses. You say they were fueling sprawl, that you did not find that they were moving jobs closer to people?
No, we didn't. We really found the opposite. And the most full-bodied analysis we were able to do is in Michigan, looking at 4,000 of the 5,000 deals there. Especially in big metro areas like Detroit and Grand Rapids, the incentive deals are very strongly skewed outwardly. For instance, one very expensive program in Michigan is called Mega. And over a four-year period, only one of those more than 100 deals in the state went into the city of Detroit, whereas many deals went to outer ring suburbs.
Well, even if they went to outer ring suburbs, I guess what the question I'm getting at, Greg, is sometimes residential suburbs will lead the expansion of a geographic area, and then the jobs follow to be closer to workers. But you specifically did not find that?
No, we actually matched up the subsidy packages with the existing population base, acknowledging what you're saying and understanding that dynamic. And found that even if you just look at sheer population ratios of where people live versus where the jobs are getting subsidized, there was a mismatch.
And the title of your book, The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging and the Myth of Job Creation, refers to that the myth of job creation. Describe that myth.
Sure. There's a popular myth that's, you know, promulgated by companies and their consultants and public relations machines suggesting that tax breaks like the ones we're talking about are responsible for companies locating or relocating or expanding. I think that's just not true because all state and local taxes combined as a cost of doing business for the average company in this country come to less than 1% of their cost structure. Tax breaks, therefore comprising some fraction of less than 1% of a company's costs, you know, can't create markets, can't drive innovation, can't drive skilled labor. It's really become a way for elected officials to take credit for things that are already going to happen in the market. And by letting these programs become so loose and allowing them to become pro-sprawl factors, we've also allowed these incentive programs to turn into things that are really harming our land use, undermining our public schools, forcing people away from transit, things that a lot of people would disagree with.
But if it helps make my real estate deal work, then it's much more significant to me than 1%, right?
If you as an individual person selling your land to the company located there, you're going to make a big profit on your piece of land, sure. But we have to look, you know, as elected, we hope our elected officials look at the broader policy issues about how policies affect everybody paying taxes to the city, to the county, to the state. And what's really going on is a burden shift in which companies that are footloose or that can threaten to be footloose are getting lots of other people to pay for their public services. Because when a company doesn't pay its fair share of the cost of public services it uses, everybody else either has to pay higher taxes or get lousier public services.
And that includes other businesses.
Absolutely, especially small businesses and businesses that are not able to be footloose. They're really getting the short end of the stick.
But how did we get here?
Well, it's a complicated story. I trace the roots of this back to the 30s, actually, to a company called the Fantas Factory Relocating Service. It's the granddaddy of all site location consulting firms. It really took off after World War II, and by the 60s and 70s, you had a full-scale, you know, sort of regional economic war going on in this country in which many companies did relocate, especially from the Midwest and the Northeast to the South, you know, as the interstate highway system expanded, as air conditioning made work sites more feasible in the South, as companies sought to evade unionization, especially in manufacturing. It's become an industry ever since. So we now have hundreds of site location consulting firms, and the average state now has more than 30 different ways it subsidizes jobs.
Really? 30 different ways?
Yeah.
If local taxes represent, local and state taxes, I suppose, represent less than 1% of a company's expense structure, why would a company fight so hard, spend so much time, spend so much money on attorneys and lobbyists and so forth to get these subsidies? What's the point?
Sure. Now, here's the return on investment. I lay it out for the case of Raytheon. At the time that Raytheon, for instance, lobbied for a big tax break from the state of Massachusetts, it claimed that it would save something on the order of $20 million a year if it got the tax break. When the lobbying reports were later filed, it turned out the company had spent less than $1 million on a team of consultants to help it win the tax break, and that was a one-time expense for a tax break they said at the time would save them 20 times more every single year. So that's why this happens. The modest amount of money a company might spend on a consultant to land a big tax break can generate a big return on investment.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Greg LeRoy. He's author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and The Myth of Job Creation, and founder and director of the nonprofit center Good Jobs First. A lot of people think that public subsidies for business may be out of control, but that they shouldn't be eliminated. And you seem to agree. How can they be reined in sensibly and yet still preserve the flexibility government needs to do its job?
Yeah, I think there's no one single answer to that. The raft of reforms that I lay out, because there's so many embedded self-interest in the current system, you have to get at it a lot of different ways. We think disclosure is fundamental, that is, annual company-specific reporting of the costs and benefits of every deal. In states that have had disclosure for a while and the disclosure system is getting used, we think a lot of bad deals are just not happening anymore. Minnesota is a good case in point. Clawbacks, money-back guarantee language for companies with if they fail to deliver so that we can get money back from deals that don't pay off and use the money elsewhere. Job quality standards, the wage and health care rules I talked about. Something called a unified development budget. A lot of states right now don't even know how much money they're spending for economic development, especially on the tax side of the ledger, that is the uncollected tax side, which is always the bottom of the iceberg, 6-to-1, 8-to-1, 10-to-1, more than the appropriations you'd see for a training grant, for instance, or something like that. But very few state legislators have a comprehensive picture every year of how the money's actually being spent. Those are the fundamental reforms.
You call for money back deals for corporations that receive public subsidies and then do not fulfill their responsibilities. Could you find any evidence of a government demanding its money back?
Oh, clawbacks now are very common. They were an exotic European import 20 years ago, being touted by a few far-sighted academics. Today, we know that for a fact, 19 states have clawbacks on the book for at least one of their incentive programs. We think they're being used by many dozens of cities and counties, especially for bigger and higher profile deals. We know from press reports that companies are being required to pay back. And the other thing we know is that there's almost no litigation going on between cities and companies anymore. Unlike 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was a spate of lawsuits from the mid-80s to the mid-90s involving cities who thought they had gotten ripped off and the companies had broken promises. But there was nothing in writing, and often the governments lost those lawsuits because of the lack of a good contract. Now with good contracts, good clawbacks, everybody understands in black and white where they stand, and we just don't see a lot of arguments about these deals anymore.
Communities give these subsidies on the face of it because they want the jobs, although in some cases it likely has more to do with developing the real estate than with creating jobs. But that's another subject. What is the most effective way, in your opinion, for communities to get what they want, jobs?
The number one site location advantage today is to have an adequate supply of skilled labor. And that means having good schools, having a good job training workforce development program, vocational education program. That means not allowing your property tax abatement system or your tax increment financing system to undermine your public schools in a way that will hurt the quality of your public schools. We have an enormous wave of retirements about to hit. 76 million baby boomers begin turning retirement age in just two more years. The net growth in the U.S. labor force is flattening out almost to nothing over the next few decades. The places that will be the economic development winners in the 21st century are the places with skilled labor, not big tax breaks.
Obviously, one problem here is that if Community A offers subsidies, then Community B feels it must also offer subsidies just to be competitive. Have you seen examples of federal or state or regional legislation limiting this competition among communities?
Funny you should ask. We're just about to put an email blast out this afternoon summarizing some best practices at both the regional and federal level on that exact issue. There's a modest body of experience in metro areas, especially like Denver and the San Francisco Bay Area, where local governments have come together and agreed to rules of conduct, so to speak, to not pirate jobs from each other, to not actively solicit or use incentives to pirate jobs from each other. And that's a very valuable experience. And at the federal level, mostly driven by some high-profile scandals, almost every major federal economic development and training program now has interstate anti-piracy rules attached to it, and we'll be issuing those as well. But the issue really is cooperation. We ran across the case of Bloomington, Minnesota, one of the study in our Twin City study coming out. A fascinating thing I'll tell ahead of time from the study. The development director there has a standard email that he has ready to send to anybody who approaches him asking for a big tax break. And he basically says, you know, we think everybody wins if we provide the best public services possible for the lowest possible tax rate. We want to have great public services, but we want to treat everybody fairly and equally. So we'll be sure, we'd love to have you come to Bloomington. We're going to treat you just like everybody else, but we're not going to go through the shenanigans of cutting special deals for a few people at Huff and Puff and shortchange everybody else.
What's the response been?
Bloomington, is doing quite well. The Twin Cities area has a unique system of sharing some of the property tax revenue of commercial industrial properties in the region. It's gone a long way toward helping St. Paul and Minneapolis and inner-ring suburbs like Bloomington sustain themselves. Bloomington is a big net loser in that system, actually, and the biggest, I think, in the region. But still and yet, they believe in treating everybody fairly.
Greg, thanks for talking with us on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Greg LeRoy is founder and director of Good Jobs First. President Franklin Roosevelt wrote, "In the truest sense, freedom cannot be bestowed. It must be achieved." This week, CityView's commentator Walker Smith explains that the road to freedom has not always been smooth.
Recently, my wife Joy and I were at an outdoor symphony sponsored by a local church. The last thing the orchestra played was a medley of military service anthems, and people were asked to stand during each anthem corresponding to a branch of the military in which a member of their family had served. Until we were at this concert, standing during all of the anthems, Joy and I had not realized that members of our respective families had served in every branch of the service. One of Joy's ancestors was President Cornwallis's surrender at Yorktown. We both had many forebears in the Civil War, and we could name and in many cases knew those who had served in World Wars I and II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Gulf. Military service runs deep in our families. And it runs deep in the American family, too. We all know of the sacrifices so many have made to ensure the opportunities, comforts, and security we enjoy. As my retired Air Force cousin likes to sign off his letters and emails, freedom is not free. The sacrifice that we ask of others to preserve our freedom is not to be taken lightly or to be casually demanded. We must always make sure that we are making meaningful commitments in smart ways. Otherwise, the sacrifice will be squandered. It is worth reminding ourselves that America, like every great nation throughout history, has launched both good and bad campaigns. Far more often than not, America has fought the good fight, defending freedom and democracy. But when we are honest with ourselves, we can point to involvements that have not reflected the best of our national spirit and ideals. the eras of manifest destiny during the 1840s and again during the 1890s, saw campaigns waged for little more than conquest and territorial expansion. The Cold War during the decades after World War II saw covert campaigns of destabilization, insurgency, and invasion. Our ambitions, while understandable, often overwhelmed our principles. And if the commitment we ask is to be worthy of the sacrifice required, then we must constantly be examining our assumptions and holding our actions accountable. America is a beacon of hope around the world, a nation founded on an idea of freedom, not an inheritance of geography or clan. The world looks to us for our example more than our might. Our resources, wealth, knowledge, and military strength are important, but what inspires the world is our commitment to freedom and democracy. We have had our own rocky patches, the 1850s and 1860s, the 1930s, the 1960s, and even in this century in the disputed 2000 presidential election. But our shared values and democratic ethic have carried us through. We are not a perfect nation, and we have a history of falling prey to hubris and immoderation. But if we remember to never be too certain of the justice and honorability of our cause, and to continually question even those things we feel sure are right, then we will preserve what makes America great, and what makes us proud to honor those who have given their all, so that we can enjoy so much. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.